Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Ben Rylan, and on the show today, we'll be getting the lowdown on the podcasts and films you should be downloading and lining up to see this week. I'll be joined here in the studio by podcast critic Pete Norton and the film critic for The Telegraph, Tim Robey, who'll be putting their expert opinions to good use. And elsewhere on the program, we'll speak to the art newspaper's Jane Morris about what's on at the galleries this weekend, and we'll find out why a gig in South London was a cultural highlight of the year so far for one member of Monocle's staff. And we'll discover the star performances from this year's South by Southwest Music Showcase in Austin. That's all to come on an action-packed edition of the Monocle Arts Review. Do stay tuned. Pete Norton and Tim Robey, welcome both to the program.
Hi. Thank you.
Now, we'll start with film and podcasts on the agenda this week, and we're going to start things off first with what's on at the cinema today. Tim, we're going to discuss Personal Shopper and Get Out. Let's begin with Personal Shopper, though, which was in the running for the Palme d'Or at last year's Cannes Film Festival. It ended up taking home the award for Best Director, which of course went to Olivier Assayas. What did you think of this film?
I'm a big fan of this film.
Oh, good.
It was very divisive in Cannes, actually. It got some boos in the first press screening, which is not untypical.
I mean, if you read just the synopsis, you can sort of understand why some people might have objected to this being at Cannes. It's not your typical Cannes fare.
It's true. It's because it's toying with genre, I think, without fully plunging into genre. And there are elements of the supernatural in the story involving a ghost, but you wouldn't want to say too much more than that. But being Olivier Assayas, it really is a slightly more sophisticated conceit than just a ghost story. And being Olivier Assayas collaborating for the second time with Kristen Stewart, who was in his previous film, Clouds of Sils Maria, I think he's building up a really interesting relationship with her as his kind of new muse, if you like.
I just want to talk a little bit more about how it does toy with genre, as you put it, because we actually spoke to Olivier on the cinema show, which is happening this week, and he was talking about how sometimes being a genre film, it can weigh you down with your ability to tell a story. And for him, this was really just about telling a story. For me, though, watching this film, it sort of seemed to flip all the expectations on its head straight away. At first glance, it seems like a fashion film, and then it opens inside a big, creepy old dark house, which instantly says, not all about fashion. We're actually going to be venturing into the darkness here for a little while, too. How did you find that element?
Yeah, I mean, it's very slippery and unpredictable exercise, really. As you say, you know, Kristen Stewart's character is a personal shopper to a celebrity, but she is also a medium. She's able to make contact with the dead. Her brother has recently passed away. Now, I feel as though Assayas is making a statement here about modern life and technology disconnecting us all, turning us all into ghosts in a way. And one of the most effective sequences in the film comes in the middle, where the ghostly visitation comes to Kristen Stewart's character for a good 15 minutes through text messaging and nothing else. A series of texts coming up on her phone, and those little dots that you get on your phone when you can see a text is pending become the most chilling thing you could possibly be witnessing, because you just know that this something is trying to contact her. And I think because she's completely atomized, you never really get to see who she's really working with. She's off on her own. Everyone's just kind of completely disconnected from reality in this film.
Let's hear a little clip from Personal Shopper.
Lewis, are you here? I had a sign.
Are you sure?
There was a presence.
Do you think Lewis is here?
I don't know.
That was a little clip there from Personal Shopper. And as we mentioned, coming up on the cinema show this week, I had the chance to meet the director of Personal Shopper, Olivier Assayas. Let's have a look.
I've always made movies that function on a conscious and subconscious level. I mean, and sometimes I feel that, you know, that when I'm writing, I get into areas. I'm not sure why I end up there, but somehow my thought process, that's where my thought process brings me.
That was Olivier Assayas speaking on the cinema show this week. Catch the full interview on this week's edition of the program. That's airing later today at 20:00 London time. Personal Shopper, of course, is out now in the US and in the UK. Get Out is the horror movie that everyone's been talking about for the past couple of weeks, at least. The debut film from Jordan Peele. It follows a young African-American photographer who goes to meet his white girlfriend's parents for the first time and things begin to get a little bit strange. Let's hear a clip.
Rose, we gotta go.
Is everything okay?
Rose, the keys. Just get the keys.
I don't know where they are.
Rose!
Sink into the floor.
Wait.
Sink.
Mom, it's a terrible thing to waste.
If there's too many white people, I get nervous.
A jarring clip there from Get Out. Tim, this film, I first started seeing a bit of buzz about this film around about the time that Moonlight was just everywhere. It seemed to be around Oscars time. Maybe good timing, maybe bad timing, but the film has certainly been getting amazing reviews and generating a lot of talk over in the US. Is it worth all the talk?
It really is, actually. It's broken records at the US box office. It's the first film by a black director to crack 100 million domestically. And I think one of the reasons for this is there are so many talking points in this film. It's a very bold mixture of horror and social commentary. The little trailer we just heard gives the impression of a kind of crash-bang suspense, kind of horror exercise. But really, all of that stuff is towards the end of the film. Most of it is a very stealthy build-up, and it's a situation of extreme awkwardness and unease in which the main character, played by Daniel Kaluuya, who is black, is visiting his white girlfriend's family for the first time and just begins to realize that something is slightly off. And it's just the way that the film kind of plays with their white liberal facade, in fact. These are not Trump voters. These are very much liberals who would have given Obama a third term if they could. Really kind of teases that idea in American culture at the moment, so I think does it very cunningly.
It seems to fit in with a bit of a trend we're seeing at the moment, and I mean, it sounds a bit wrong to call films that deal with race part of a trend, but it certainly is happening more and more often, certainly in the very recent past. We've had Moonlight, as we just mentioned. Loving was one that came out fairly recently as well. United Kingdom was certainly another film, and coming out very soon is the documentary I Am Not Your Negro. So it's a very good time for racial issues at the cinema at the moment. But this one deals with it in quite a different way, doesn't it? Do you think this one will stand out from those others that we've just listed?
I think it stands out precisely for that reason, because it is such a provocation. I mean, this is not a real-world scenario. It's much more satirical. And it is a horror film, but it kind of comes in the tradition of horror satire that you could trace back to the 60s and 70s, particularly the films from Ira Levin's books, like The Stepford Wives. If we think about the kind of robot wives in Suburbia and Rosemary's Baby, in fact, there are elements of those films in here, and it's all very playfully interwoven, and it is unsettling, and it does touch on some very real jangling hot button issues, I think, but it definitely resonates with what's happening right now.
Well, that is Get Out. It's out now in the United States and in the United Kingdom as well, and will continue to roll out around the world over the next couple of months too. Now, before we get into the podcasts, we're going to pause for just a moment to get this week's art recommendations from the art newspaper's editor-at-large, Jane Morris.
So my first show is Eduardo Paolozzi, which is on at the Whitechapel Gallery in London's East End until the 14th of May. Paolozzi is a sculptor who's well known to Londoners because he has a number of major sculptures dotted around the city. Probably the most famous is his sculpture of Newton, which is outside the British Library. And I think for me, this was slightly a problem with this show when I first started to approach it. I've never been a fan of these great, blocky, masculine bronze sculptures, so I approached this show with a certain degree of trepidation. But I have to say, it is something of a joy. There hasn't been a major Paolozzi show like this for very, very many years. This show starts right at the beginning of his career, at the end of the 1940s, and works all the way through until his death. He kept working almost until the end, in the mid-2000s. And what it shows is a side of Paolozzi that anyone who's familiar with those great big hefty sculptures probably doesn't know. And basically it shows his development from an artist very, very influenced by Picasso. He studied in France for some years, all the way through to the 60s where he becomes a really famous pop artist. And there's some fantastic screen prints and some super aluminium sculptures. You see the ideas that will eventually lead up to the murals at Tottenham Court Road tube station. And then you see in the 70s the kind of complete change. He becomes friends with J.G. Ballard. He becomes very, very disillusioned with America and pop. And he starts making work that I could only really describe as really quite postmodern and conceptual. And basically he sort of takes a sort of poppet himself and casts some sculptures of, they're like gold bullion, but they're in aluminium, and he calls them 100% F.art. And, you know, he's kind of, he prefigured pop by some way, and then he prefigured conceptual art by some way. So this is quite an exciting show. You see a completely different side of a man who many of us, I think, feel like we're quite familiar with. And you see this playful, very creative, sometimes quite dark, often very witty artist. My second choice is America After the Fall, painting in the 1930s, which is at the Royal Academy in London until the 4th of June. So basically, this is a very tightly curated show. It's only 45 paintings, but some of these paintings are so engaging and so unfamiliar to, I think, to most British visitors that if you can sort of make the time to go and see it, I definitely would. It starts in 1930, and those of us who are sort of maybe a little shaky on the American history, it's worth thinking that this is 1 year after the Great Crash, 1929, the Wall Street crash. The Great Depression is in full swing. There's the Great Migration is happening as well, which is the move of many black people from the South to the North to escape persecution. It's a time when people are leaving the rural land, small-time farmers are leaving to join America's growing cities. And at the same time, fascism is rising in Europe. So this is a very, very turbulent time in American history. And I think when you step into the show, you are almost immediately transported back to the era of John Steinbeck and The Grapes of Wrath, to the Hollywood Golden Era, to Raymond Chandler, even to films like Public Enemy. And you can see that this is a time when America really doesn't know in which direction it's going. A lot of the artists in the show were communists, but not all of them. Some of them were advocating a return to America's rural past. One common thread, though, throughout the exhibition is that most of the paintings deal with the life of the common man, and they are the sorts of concerns that many people are wrestling with today. And I think that everybody who's any interest in American history or this history of a post-recession world will find this a fascinating show. My final choice is Wolfgang Tillmann's. That's at Tate Modern until the 11th of June. It's really quite nice, I think, for the Tate to have given a large show to a contemporary artist. I think he's a fascinating photographer because many people see him, I think, or used to see him as maybe part of the slightly sort of fashion world of the 90s, of the kind of club scene. And he does indeed document those things. But I think this exhibition makes a really very convincing case for him as a very serious, thoughtful artist and somebody who has grappled with photography as an exciting and complex medium. He makes a lot of work that are actually about the photographic process itself. So there are some absolutely beautiful abstract and semi-abstract pictures where he is using the techniques of making photographs as his subject matter. I think the other thing is it shows how increasingly political Tillmann's has become. And I think it shows how much he's been engaging with the politics of the time. And one of the most sort of moving pictures in the exhibition is a cardboard box. It looks like it's in his studio and it's full of retroviral drugs. And I think it's called something like 14 Years Supply. So he's been talking about a lot of the social issues, gender, being gay, being straight, HIV, AIDS, refugees. And I think that if anybody really just knew him, as I say, as somebody who is working for magazines like ID, where he had, when he was young, he did a lot of work for. I think this shows what a serious and committed artist he's become.
Thanks to Jane Morris. This is the Monocle Arts Review, and I'm Ben Rylan. And I'm joined in the studio by Tim Robey, who just gave us his film picks of the week. And Pete Norton is also here. He's about to tell us about what we should be downloading and listening to in the realm of podcasts. Pete, back in January, the New York Times announced a new podcast called The Daily. Now, we knew back then that it would be about 20 minutes long and would be some sort of agenda setter for the day, but we weren't entirely sure what it would be like. What's your verdict on what they've come up with?
I think they've actually done very well with this. So it's, I mean, the New York Times have been putting resources and money into a podcast operation for some time, for a couple of years now. And this is sort of their most ambitious thing yet. They've rolled out a few shows which are kind of weekly discussion. They've got a culture theme show. They've done a kind of Radio 4 style quiz. They've done a show about relationships and romance. But this is a sort of daily. It lands at 6 a.m. Eastern time, which is 11 a.m. in the UK every weekday. And they record it the night before, so it's not trying to be exactly what's happening in the headlines. It's more of a kind of deep dive into the stories that are simmering, if I can mix those metaphors, and makes great use of the New York Times resources in terms of journalists who are working on stories, contacts, sources, and has a more discursive and conversational sort of approach than your standard Voice of God objective news bulletin. It's something a bit more like the kind of email bulletins that some publications send to their subscribers.
I suppose it's sort of playing in a funny sort of area, isn't it? Because the New York Times, their reputation is built upon breaking news. It's built upon telling people what's happening right now. Whereas in the age of the internet, newspapers aren't really that thing anymore. They're not telling us what's happening at the breaking moment. They're helping us digest what might be happening with some sort of larger look at the whole big picture. Do you think that's maybe where the richness of the podcast medium is going to maybe kick in for someone like the New York Times?
Definitely. And I think to bring, podcasts tend to succeed when they bring in a personal aspect to the story. And it's not a question of sensationalizing the news and turning it into a sort of personality contest, but there is something here about hearing journalists describe the way that they're working in a more kind of open-handed way than you might get in a conventional news show. I was dubious whether they were going to succeed with this or not, but I have been listening almost every day. And, you know, they've had a lot of different, a lot of it's been Trump-themed, as you might imagine. But they had a very good edition yesterday about the rise of the far right in Europe. They had a really interesting interview the other day with a man, an American lawyer who represents Russian hackers in when they come to trial in America. So you get these really interesting perspectives on things that you don't necessarily hear on PM or on your standard news programs.
We've got a little bit of a taster from an episode this week that focused on the death penalty.
Near Grady, Arkansas, along the Arkansas River, sits the Varner Unit. The high security prison is where the state keeps its inmates who are waiting to die.
So you've got eight men in Arkansas who have been on death row, in some cases, for decades.
Alan Blinder is a reporter for The Times based in the South.
These are men who were convicted of some of the most heinous crimes that a state can ever see.
And now, after years of waiting, these eight men are scheduled to die.
It is a pace of execution that researchers say is unprecedented in the modern history of the death penalty in the United States.
The voice of Michael Barbaro there, of course, the host of The Daily, the new podcast from The New York Times. Tim, maybe can I direct a question at you? Because you, of course, well, I'm assuming that you like to consume podcasts every now and then. For you, what makes a good podcast? Do you prefer something that is maybe towards the more traditional radio format, or do you think podcasting should feel free to take on an entirely different model?
Yeah, as you were sort of suggesting, I quite like a bit of a personal touch, some sort of sense of authorship, or that there's sort of one guiding intelligence kind of picking the material or sifting through it. I do listen to some film podcasts. There's one about old Hollywood cinema called You Must Remember This that I'm very fond of, which is very much the personal taste of the presenter, Karina Longworth, and her enthusiasms.
A current series focused on Dead Blondes, which I'm very much enjoying now.
It really is similar to the way I consume, in fact, radio, which is that particularly on something like Six Music, I rather like the individual taste of the presenters coming through in their segment. So I don't really want it just to be a kind of corporate choice, what I'm listening to. I want it to be a personal choice.
Indeed. Pete, one more question on this one, because to me it is quite interesting that it's basically a news podcast of which there are multiple available on iTunes. So it is entering a fairly crowded marketplace. However, this one seems to stand apart because for me, it takes a different model. It takes a different approach to the usual news podcast in that it feels as though it's quite often discovering the news with you. It's sort of taking you on this journey. So you don't always know what's going to be discussed at the beginning of the show, but you've sort of got a guide with you as you walk through a certain issue. And Michael Barbaro is that guide.
Yeah, I think it brings, I mean, you could say it brings a bit more of a sort of This American Life sensibility to current affairs. A lot of news podcasts now, I mean, this, they also, they've clearly put serious resources into this, and they must be on an absolute breakneck schedule to be making five a week.
I think they've got about three producers just working on this one 20-minute podcast.
Yeah, it kind of shows, because a lot of news podcasts are, it's like one phone interview with an expert, and that's your show. Like, that's what Trump, I love Trumpcast. The Washington Post have one called Can He Do That, which is about Donald Trump.
And Meet the Press has a daily podcast as well, hosted by Chuck Todd. But it's usually, you just get the sense that Chuck Todd has ducked into a room during his busy, hectic day, sat there with a Zoom recorder, and then dialed up someone. I mean, exactly. That's pretty much it for 40 minutes.
Exactly. Whereas this is multi-part, and, you know, there's a lot of moving parts to this and a lot of legwork that's gone into it. And just the soundscape, you know, the way they weave in ambient background sound and music and everything, it's just has that kind of professional sheen to it, and it's doing well. You know, I think this show, it's number two in the US charts at the moment, so I've got a feeling they'll be happy with the results of this.
Well, that is The Daily, which is the new podcast from the New York Times, of course, not to be confused with The Monocle Daily, which airs live at 2200 every weekday on Monocle 24. Now, podcasts have become a vehicle for creative storytelling, the rise of true crime, and revisiting cold cases too. The latest hit to follow along these lines, sort of, is Missing Richard Simmons, which launched in February and looks into the disappearance, sort of a man who was last seen in February 2014. Pete, first of all, most people, I think, will be aware of who Richard Simmons is, the rather eccentric fitness fanatic. Give us your nutshell version of who Richard Simmons is.
He's one of those people that as soon as you've heard his voice, you'll remember who he is. He's had cameos in various films, but he's this very flamboyant. He looks a little bit like Leo Sayer, if that helps.
Yeah, he does.
American fitness chap, and he's got big kind of frizzy brown hair, and he often wears kind of, you know, leotards, and is very, as you might imagine, very motivating and enthusiastic.
He could either be incredibly happy or at breaking point and in tears over something.
Well,
there's pretty much two modes to Richard Simmons.
Yeah, I mean, what comes out in this podcast, so the sort of the story is Richard, in February 2014, he just disappeared from view. And, you know, he was known as being this incredibly gregarious man. And very welcoming to people, that he would, when the tour buses stopped outside his house in LA, he would often run out and meet them. And there's loads of stories that come out in the podcast of people who he had individually taken on to help with weight problems and stuff. People who he had no obligation to do that, but he was in lasting contact with them, you know, years after they'd met. So he comes across as, you know, as really quite a generous, spirited man. And then he disappeared from view in 2014. The maker of this podcast, Dan Taberski, was a filmmaker. And he was a regular at Simmons's fitness classes in Los Angeles, but was also angling to make a documentary with him. And when Simmons disappeared, Taberski began to formulate this idea of making it into trying to find out what had happened to him. And that's where this podcast has arrived.
It's relatively new, the podcast. However, Richard Simmons has sort of popped up again since the podcast became quite successful, hasn't he? So has that really thrown a spanner in their little machine?
I don't think so. I mean, I know there have been various stories reporting on Richard Simmons, and that there have been a few developments in the case, but I don't think that the mystery as such has been solved.
As to why he decided to step away.
Yes. It certainly hasn't affected the ratings of this podcast, which is it's top of the US charts at the moment, and it's doing well in the UK. There is a question about the sort of ethics of the show, whether it's in some ways an invasion of privacy and sort of using someone's personal anguish for commercial benefit. And I think there are questions there. It's very compelling storytelling wise. It has elements of Serial. It's, you know, it's very cleverly made. The end of each episode ends with a cliffhanger, and you're really, you know, you can kind of binge it hard if you're coming to it sort of from episode one. And Taberski, as we were saying, it really brings this personal element to it. A lot of the enjoyment of the show is in Taberski's own reflections and story. He's a good raconteur himself.
Well, as you were saying, Pete, it's not just about Richard Simmons' disappearance, but also about who he is. And it includes lots of stories like how kind he was to certain people whom he helped with weight loss, like this contributor, Kathy. Let's hear a clip.
All of a sudden, Richard Simmons jumps in my life, who is full of color, and I feel suddenly hope and it was ongoing, the relationship I had with him. It was pretty amazing. It was very unexpected.
And it was about more than just Kathy and her losing weight. This relationship, it went both ways.
There was a couple of times he'd call me in the middle of the night. It was usually a quiet time for him where he was reflecting. I really don't have any information to disclose about that other than he is a human being and hurts in the middle of the night like many of us do.
Kathy went on to lose 200 pounds, and the catalyst was Richard.
Tim, it's different to the podcast you mentioned earlier, You Must Remember This, but I feel that they sort of occupy a fairly similar territory. The difference, of course, being that Richard Simmons, apart from not being an old Hollywood star, also is not dead. Most of the people dealt with in You Must Remember This are long gone, and part of the fascination about telling these stories is that they're not around anymore, so there is quite a firm bookend up against their story. We mentioned a little bit earlier Dead Blondes is the current series that You Must Remember This is covering, all about certain blonde movie stars from the golden age of Hollywood who passed away and the various reasons that they might have passed away. It's a little bit different to maybe develop a story in a similar genre about someone who's still here?
Yeah, it requires, I imagine, quite a lot of sleight of hand in terms of kind of weaving your way around the questions of what he's doing now and what exactly his reaction would be to all of this, and not giving away certain secrets. I don't know how long they're intending to spin this out for. Is it a very fixed
duration? From what I gather, he's already recorded the episodes because he does reference things that happen in future editions. So I think there's probably a 10-episode run of this.
So they've sort of decided how to structure the story or the mystery of it and at what point to pass it out certain types of information.
Yes,
I mean,
yeah.
Well, in which case it feels like a much more sculpted form of podcast, really.
It is something that we have trouble understanding, perhaps because our culture worships the concept of celebrity so much that when someone decides quite intentionally to not be a celebrity anymore, it tends to confuse a lot of people. But that is a story for another day. Missing Richard Simmons is released weekly. Find out more at findingrichardsimmons.com. Pete Norton and Tim Robey, thank you both very much for talking us through this week's films and podcasts. Now in its 31st year, South by Southwest has grown to be the biggest music showcase festival in the world. Over the years, it's swelled in size, moving from downtown Austin to just about anywhere in Austin that you can plug a microphone in. Every year, thousands of artists, music industry people, journalists, and more take over the town for a week of showcasing music, barbecues, margaritas, and of course, lots of socializing in between. We sent our reporter, Mar Sellers, to wade through the numbers to find out the acts that people are talking about and who we should be paying attention to.
The first band recommended to me is Berlin's Shat, self-described as like Ian Curtis, naked in Cairo at 3:30 in the morning.
And it sounds better than like David Bowie in clothes in Berlin, so...
Dorothy Parent Roy from Believe Digital has a hot tip.
I really want to see Let's Eat Grandma again. I saw them last fall in Montreal, but I'm curious to see how they grew since then. You know, they're still pretty young, and I think they're only 15 years old. They're this crazy duo of girls from the UK. They play like recorder, and they clap their hands like patty cake style, and they play both instruments, switch drums and guitars, and it's just this kind of mind-blowing experience that you go out of there and just what did I just saw and witness. And
that was a little bit of Sax in the City by Norwich's Let's Eat Grandma. More recommendations, this time from Brighton musician Adam Al-Halali.
The best thing I've seen, I've got some guilty pleasures in hip-hop, and I've got to admit it was Jay Electronica on the first night. But I do like Big Moon.
We're in a band called the Big Moon. South by Southwest so far is really great. We played one show and it was a solid banger of a set, and I think people really enjoyed it.
Are there any other bands you would recommend?
Dreamwife, who are playing right now, who we should go and watch. They're really, really good.
Yeah.
And Fourth Wanderers.
Hey, it's Alice from Dreamwife.
And Bella, also from Dreamwife.
How's your South by Southwest going?
Oh, it's a bit mental. It's too much to handle.
Can you describe what kind of show you're playing tonight?
We're going to play a rock show tonight, have no fear.
Oh, but we're at this place that I think it's a university halls. I'm not sure. There's a pool. There's a swing.
Yeah. It could become a pool party at some point, but it isn't right now.
We saw someone fall in the pool earlier, but that was definitely an accident.
Yeah, that wasn't it.
We've got like 10 shows over 5 days, so we kind of haven't really allowed ourselves to look at who else is playing.
Exactly. Sometimes the best shows at South by Southwest are the most underground. Both Dreamwife and Big Moon played a university dorm. But to get to a serious note, the underlying theme of this year, of course, was the immigration issue. Bands being refused entry to the USA, artists being deported, Trump's ban on refugees, and some extreme legal language in the South by Southwest contracts with international artists raised a few eyebrows. Here's Canada's Supermoon. Was there anything that's going on in like the current climate that would make you sort of hesitate about playing South by Southwest? Or touring the States?
Yeah, I would say so. There is obviously the stuff in the contract about the deportation, which made us kind of hesitant in general. And it felt weird maybe to like support a festival that was doing that. But
coming to America while Trump is president is like already kind of scary. You know, it's just like immigration, going across the border, even with P2 visas that we got while, like during a different presidency, was like, are they gonna question that? Or, you know.
I think what we feel is mostly when you see a band was supposed to be there and got replaced by someone else, and like we saw a lineup sheet today, like Soviet being replaced by this band. I think people are trying not to focus so much on that, I guess, because I mean it's South by, and at some point you want to have a good time anyway, and you just drink more instead, I guess.
It'll be interesting to watch how South by Southwest accommodates over the years to the U.S. government's changing policies on travel. It did feel like the crowds seemed to be slightly smaller than previous years, but they were still so overwhelming it was hardly noticeable. For Monocle in Austin, I'm Mar Sellers.
Thank you, Ma. Now, every week here on The Arts Review, we hear from one of Monocle's staff about something in the cultural spectrum that's been on their mind this week. Today, it's the turn of our business editor, Matt Alagaya, who's been on a high all week after a particular concert that he went to last Saturday. No, not that kind of high.
Last week, London band The XX held a residency at one of the capital's best venues, the O2 Academy in Brixton. And alongside that, they had a whole range of events in the local area called Night and Day, which was a kind of festival that happened at the same time. Say something loving. I just don't remember the thrill of affection. So I listened to the first album when it first came out, and I thought it was really amazing and very, very kind of original, completely unique. And then I didn't actually listen too much to the second album. But when I realised I had tickets for this show, I downloaded the third album, which is their newest, called I See You. And I think it's absolutely brilliant. And it's a kind of a bit of a gear change for them from the first album. And so most of the songs that they played on Saturday night were from the new album, I See You. I'm in love with it, intoxicated. Behind the three of them, they had these mirrors, basically, which were vast, vast mirrors. So they were probably, I don't know, 10 meters high behind them on the stage. And these were swerving, they were kind of rotating from the middle, each of them. And out of the sides of the mirrors, they had basically lights that could change colour. So at one point they were completely rainbow, each one, and it looked incredibly impressive. And then they had a mirror hanging from the ceiling. A lot of the marketing around this new album was mirrors. So in the London Underground you have these adverts at the moment which are a mirror with just the faintest X written on it. And that mirror that was suspended above them was able to kind of move down and show a bit more of the crowd at certain points. It all looked very slick and very impressive, and I think just like the set list, you could see that they'd agonised over the way that they were going to design the set. I've since listened to the album pretty much constantly every time I am out of the house, basically. And it's interesting, you kind of pick up a few things that you didn't pick up before. I think they were pretty true to the album in most of the songs. They might have extended some of the bits that were particularly kind of dancey, but basically it was fairly true to the album. And just listening to it, I think there are some songs that I probably would have overlooked before, but then now I'm really listening to with a bit more kind of attention, I guess. And On Hold is definitely one of those. So that was the first song they played when they came back for the encore. And the way that it builds and builds, you know, it starts very, very quiet and soft, and it builds and builds, and it's a fantastic song. And I think having seen them live, I kind of realised a few of the songs on the album deserve a bit more attention. I do think it was a great show. Probably, I'm not sure I'll see a better one this year. And every time I let you leave, I always saw you coming back to me.
Matt. Now, before we end the show, it's time for our global countdown, and our usual worldwide chart expert, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, is, unsurprisingly, off travelling. He's headed off to sunnier climates this week, so in his place, we'll welcome, a relatively poor imitation, Bill Luthi.
It's big shoes I've got to fill, isn't it?
It's very big and very colourful shoes.
Probably custom made.
Indeed. Now, this week has been a unique one in the music charts worldwide, and that's all down to Ed Sheeran. Who knew? He's reached number one in almost every country. How is that possible? As well as occupying plenty of other spots besides. Bill, what do you make of that little piece of trivia?
Well, I was expressing my irritation at Ed Sheeran. I'll come out now and say I'm not his biggest fan.
Really?
And I was hoping not to have to talk to him about him, but basically
hoping not
we've been,
to have to talk to him. No, well, you're in luck because he's not here.
We've been left with not much option. When he released two singles at the same time with the release of this album back in January, and they both reached number one and number two, I thought that was a bit of a publicity stunt.
A publicity stunt?
Well, I don't know.
You weren't sniffing a conspiracy theory at all?
He wanted to see if he could do it. And then he did. And then I was like, well, what's next? Is he going to get the whole top 10? Well, guess what, Ben? He's not only got almost all of the top 10, he has 14 of the top 15 songs in the UK chart this week.
That's absolutely shocking.
The only other artist is Monocle 24 favourite Chainsmokers featuring Coldplay. I think the top 15 is a sorry place to be.
So, I mean,
this week.
Look, I'll be honest, I haven't listened to commercial radio. You know, the kind you listen to when you're in high school. I haven't listened to that in quite a long time, but I seem to recall that there were certain radio shows on at a certain time each night that would actually go through the top, you know, the top 20 or something, and they'd actually play them all. I'm imagining those shows would be fairly boring at the moment.
Well, they can just whack on Ed Sheeran's album and then go home. It's pretty good, isn't it? So basically, there is an explanation for this. Since in the UK, we've started including streaming as part of the charts.
Streaming as well as downloads.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So it's because of Spotify, basically. So yeah. His album is released. He said that he was going on a break from releasing music for a bit. It's an extraordinarily well-timed comeback. And people have just been streaming like absolute crazy. To get one point, so basically a download or a single purchase is 1 point. For a single point, you need 150 streams. So people have been listening to this non-stop, and Ed Sheeran hasn't been doing anything to try and stop people. He's been encouraging people to listen again and again. He tweeted, if you're playing this, play it on speakers so everybody can hear. He's been he's really ramping it up. And as you said, it's number one in it's in the charts in almost every single country we could find. I was looking for a place where it wasn't number one and we were struggling.
Well, this reminds me of the time that Oprah really wanted her new network to rate really well. So she asked people to watch it. And that turns out that's against the rules. And she got into trouble.
Well, I think Ed Sheeran's allowed to do that. And I found out it wasn't even written for him. He went to a writing session. He was writing songs for whoever. He thought this one might be good for Rihanna. And then he thought to himself, no, actually, I'll just have it. And then banged it on the album.
Well, he's got so much. Why wouldn't he? I have a theory about this, though, because on Spotify and all of those music streaming apps, so on, it's actually very easy to just play a song that you like and then let the app, the machine, choose the rest.
It just plays the next, doesn't
it? Yeah. Like, so an algorithm is actually deciding what you listen to next, because most people can't be bothered. Well, a lot of people can't be bothered sitting there and actually making their own choices.
So like me, Ben, you're blaming Ed Sheeran's chart success on other people's stupidity.
No, I'm blaming it on the algorithm.
Right.
I think we've officially got to that point in the dystopian future where computers are taking over and they're even deciding our music taste for us.
What do you make of that?
I think it's quite terrifying. I think I might be on the brink of one of those network-style breakdowns live on air. We better move on quickly.
Start talking about something else.
Well, Ed Sheeran has had just about enough airplay. And I know you have another song that's been big in the Latin American market. You really are trying to fill Fernando Augusto Pacheco's shoes. Let's hear a clip of Bill Say It For Me.
This is Despacito.
Look, it's a lovely song, but it kind of reminds me of something I might have heard on 100% Hits 1999.
I think it's a bit of a classic sound, Ben.
Classic sound, is that what they're calling
it
now?
Yeah, the classic Latin American
sound. We're
that
old now.
Those smooth tones you could hear. That was Luis Fonsi, and the guy in the background saying, "Hey, hello, that's Daddy Yankee." And they're both Puerto Rican artists, Ben.
Really?
The song means, Despacito, means slowly. So it's a bit of a, I think it's a bit of a love song, but might be edging into slightly sexy.
Oh, very suggestive then.
Yeah, this song is number one in, are you ready?
Ready.
Argentina, Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, Spain, Guatemala, Mexico, Panama, Paraguay, and Peru. Top 10, Dominican Republic, Italy, Luxembourg, Portugal, Slovakia, Switzerland, Uruguay, and Venezuela, Ben.
I am so pleased that all of those countries have not fallen victim to the Ed Sheeran algorithm.
Oh, don't worry. He's in the top 10 as well.
Oh, right. Okay.
So it's broken a number of records. It's the first Spanish language song to reach the top 10 on Spotify's global chart. Well done, them. That's about it. That's all the facts I have about it. No.
Okay, so you're out of facts, but what else do we need to know about this before we wrap up?
My favourite fact about Daddy Yankee.
Yes.
He wanted to be a famous professional baseball player. And his career was scuppered when he got shot in the hip with an AK-47.
That's got to
hurt. The bullet's still in there.
Really?
Yeah. And then he thought to himself, this is it. I'm not doing this anymore. I'm going to become a rapper. It's going well for him, I think. Should I read you some lyrics, Ben?
Please do.
Let me surpass your danger zones to provoke your cries and forget your surname.
I think we'd better stop before you forget everyone else's surname as well.
It's getting a bit hot in here, isn't it?
Bill Lutie, thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Arts Review. And that indeed is the end of this week's program. Thanks to my other guests today, Beat Norton and Tim Roby. The show was produced by Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time next week. But for now, here's the rest of that number one track by Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee. This is Despacito. Despacito, quiero respirar tu cuello despacito. Deja que